The House impeachment hearings get underway this week.
We already largely know the content of what each of these three is going to say. And what we're looking at now is going to be their character, their integrity, their credibility, because for the first time, the public is going to see these witnesses firsthand and get a chance to evaluate whether they think their perspective is valid.
We'll find out how presidential candidates are observing Veterans Day and what you should know about ESG funds, socially responsible investments.
The interesting thing about ESG funds is that they can vary so much in terms of how they choose to define a company with strong environmental, social, or governance practices.
This is What's News for Monday, November 11th. I'm Charlie Turner for The Wall Street Journal. We'll have those stories in a moment. First, here are some other headlines we're following. The U.S. is commemorating Veterans Day, a federal holiday marking the end of the First World War. President Trump will be giving a speech to kick off the Veterans Day parade in New York City. The Wall Street Journal's Tarini Party says many of the Democratic presidential candidates will also be honoring veterans on the campaign trail.
Former Vice President Joe Biden is doing a Veterans Day town hall in Iowa. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg is supposed to give a Veterans Day address in New Hampshire. And Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard did a Veterans Day workout at a CrossFit in California this weekend, and she will be joining in a Veterans Day event in Los Angeles. Both Buttigieg and Gabbard are veterans.
The Federal Aviation Administration has still not lifted its ban on the grounded 737 MAX planes. But we report that Boeing is discussing with the FAA whether it can get approval to deliver the planes to airlines in December, even before regulators formally approve the training that pilots will need to fly the jet. That's according to people familiar with the matter. Delivering the planes before all the regulatory approvals are complete would relieve pressure on Boeing. Airlines have been anxious for Boeing to resume deliveries of the MAX and want to avoid bottlenecks and long waits once the plane is cleared for service. Under the plan, airlines still wouldn't fly the plane with passengers until the pilot training occurs. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, has resigned following weeks of protest in the country over his re-election, which was marred by widespread allegations of fraud. Election monitors said the October 20th vote should be annulled. Morales, who had pledged to hold new elections, announced his resignation after support from his closest allies crumbled. He had also appeared to lose the support of the police and military. His opponents said he should not participate in new elections. And November 11th is also 11-11, or if you like, 4-1s, and it's now known as Singles Day in China. That was a gimmick dreamed up by the online retail giant Alibaba to encourage single people to shop and buy something nice for themselves. Wall Street Beijing reporter Stu Wu explains it's become a huge day for retail in China.
Alibaba started this event by itself 10 years ago, but it's gotten so big that basically every company, whether it's online or offline, gets involved. I like to describe Singles Day as a hybrid between Black Friday, because it's the biggest shopping day in China, and the Super Bowl, because there's all sorts of crazy advertisements and gimmicks that go around it. Last year, only Alibaba sold $31 billion worth of goods. To put that in perspective, that's more than all American retailers sold online on Black Friday and Cyber Monday combined.
This year, those sales will be especially important. Alibaba is looking to raise $10 to $15 billion through a listing on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange this week, which it's expected to seek approval for after Singles Day. 5 years ago, Alibaba had the largest IPO in history when they raised $25 billion on the New York Stock Exchange. A new chapter in the House Democratic impeachment probe begins this week with public hearings. The nation will get a chance to hear directly from witnesses in the inquiry of President Trump's dealings with Ukraine. Joining us to preview the hearings is The Wall Street Journal's Siobhan Hughes. First of all, Siobhan, when do the hearings start and who is scheduled to testify?
The hearings begin on Wednesday with two State Department witnesses, George Kent, a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, Bill Taylor, who essentially functions as the acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And then on Friday, we hear from Marie Yovanovitch, Masha Yovanovitch, who was ousted as the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine earlier this year.
Now, these witnesses have already testified in closed-door depositions, the transcripts of which have been made public. Is there credibility on the line in these public hearings?
Yes, we already largely know the content of what each of these three is going to say. And what we're looking at now is going to be their character, their integrity, their credibility, because for the first time, the public is going to see these witnesses firsthand and get a chance to evaluate whether they think their perspective is valid.
Looking back a bit, Siobhan, what has stood out regarding what these witnesses have said in depositions? For instance, didn't Bill Taylor, the acting ambassador to Ukraine, speak of a quid pro quo security assistance to Russia in exchange for a promise by Ukraine to pursue investigations sought by President Trump?
Yes. So Bill Taylor has emerged really as the star witness. And the thing you have to know about Bill Taylor is he was part of what he describes as both an irregular and an irregular channel at the State Department. He was carrying out the State Department's official policy, but he also had been included in conversations with Gordon Sondland and Kurt Volker, two officials who were part of what he dubbed the irregular policy process. And through conversations with them, particularly Gordon Sondland, he says he came to learn, or at least about Gordon Sondland, he came to learn that there was, in fact, a quid pro quo, in fact, more than one involving using a White House meeting as leverage to press Ukraine to conduct investigations into Joe Biden and the origins of the 2016 Russian or election interference cases. And then also a separate quid pro quo involving military aid, withholding about $400 million in aid to Ukraine until those same investigations were initiated or committed to.
What about Masha Yovanovitch? Was her closed-door deposition compelling?
Her deposition was different from that of anyone else, probably because she is the person who's a casualty in all of this. She's the person who lost their job. From the transcripts, we can see there are points when the deposition had to stop because she became clearly upset. You also see her as somebody who really has a diplomatic background. She really refrained from attacks, from pulling any punches. She is somebody who's really of a different ilk than the people you're going to see on Wednesday.
Haven't Republicans built a wish list of witnesses they say should be called, including Hunter Biden, the son of presidential candidate Joe Biden?
Yes. Republicans want to hear from Hunter Biden and also a good friend of Hunter Biden's who served on the board of Burisma, the Ukrainian gas company. They've also asked to hear from the whistleblower, anyone with whom the whistleblower has spoken. These are viewed as unlikely to happen. The Democrats have veto power over which witnesses do come in to speak, but they certainly allow Republicans to make a talking point and attempt to shift the focus of the conversation elsewhere.
And we should add that other potential witnesses have joined a lawsuit, in effect, saying that they don't have to obey congressional subpoenas. Isn't that true?
I think what you're referencing is a lawsuit that was originally filed by a guy named Charles Kupperman, who was a deputy to then National Security Advisor John Bolton. Since then, John Bolton has joined that, and also now Mick Mulvaney, the acting White House Chief of Staff, is attempting to join that. And what they're asking is they're asking for a court to decide whether, in fact, because they worked for the president, they have absolute immunity and can't testify, or whether there are congressional prerogatives at stake. And in fact, in this instance, it's important for them to testify. So they're carving out a very, very interesting position for themselves. It's not clear whether a judge is going to make any decisions in time for them to be able to show up during the impeachment inquiry.
Republicans appear divided on the question of impeachment, don't they?
So far, the House Republicans have remained entirely unified against impeaching the president. There was a vote on this earlier this year, and no Republicans broke ranks. However, we may see that change when articles of impeachment are actually brought to the House floor, because some Republicans privately have been critical of Mr. Trump. And then on the Senate side, we have seen a handful of Republicans also be reluctant to join a resolution criticizing the House impeachment process. They are Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, who's up for re-election next year in a very difficult race, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska.
Wall Street Journal congressional reporter Siobhan Hughes. Thanks a lot, Siobhan.
Thanks. Good to be here.
there's been a lot of very public environmental activism recently, and funds with a focus on socially responsible investing seem to be benefiting. So-called ESG funds, which broadly market themselves as trying to invest in companies with strong environmental, social, and governance practices, have taken in a record $13.5 billion of net new money from investors in the first three quarters of the year, according to Morningstar. But it turns out a lot of these ESG funds aren't as clean as investors might think. The Wall Street Journal's Akane Otani explains.
The interesting thing about ESG funds is that they can vary so much in terms of how they choose to define a company with strong environmental, social, or governance practices. So, you know, for instance, one fund might include shares of a big oil and gas company, not because it is the best environmentally sustainable company out there, but because it happens to be a little bit better on that metric than other peers in the energy industry. Whereas another fund might decide that, you know, to truly be a sustainable fund, it's important to exclude all companies in the energy sector. So that is one reason why you see so much variation in the composition of funds that include ESG in their prospectuses or in their marketing materials. Another reason is that a lot of the biggest asset managers have big institutional investors as some of their most important clients. And so, you know, in such cases, the argument is something like, these big institutional investors, whether we're talking about pension funds or insurance companies, they don't have as much of an appetite for risk and for deviations from major market benchmarks like the S&P 500. And so for them, it might be less important to exclude all companies in a certain sector than it is to guarantee returns within a certain standard deviation. On the other hand, you have smaller fund issuers that might be more focused specifically on fossil fuel free funds. And they would say that actually it is principally important to exclude shares of companies in the energy sector if you're going to market yourself as a sustainable fund. So there definitely is a wide variation in how different fund issuers approach this issue, and also the ways in which they will choose to incorporate ESG into their investment practices.
For more details on where the top ESG funds are investing, you can read Akane Otani's full piece on our website, wsj.com. And that's what's news for Monday, November 11th. I'm Charlie Turner for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.